The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Hi, everybody. How is this? Is this on?
Did you press the little button? Oh, was
it? Is that on? Okay. Good evening. Hi, everybody. So it's very nice to be here on Monday night, special, keeping Gil's seat warm. Is there anyone else who's here for the first time? Welcome. One of the things I think about for Dharma talks, or I don't usually say them at the beginning of a Dharma talk, but personally, I think the value of a Dharma talk maybe is in about 10% is in the words, you know. And for myself, it's like the purpose of a Dharma talk is to convey some experience of the Dharma. So I invite you to listen in a way that feels as if it's a continuation of your meditation. You know, when I listen to Dharma talks, I would say it's a little embarrassing to say, probably 30% is with the speaker, you know, and then the rest is kind of with my own process, my body, breath. So, of course, you're welcome to listen however you wish, but that's, you know, I find that helpful. I was, during the sitting, kind of just appreciating the silence here. Not necessarily the kind of silence that is the opposite of noise, but the kind of silence that includes everything, you know, that has a space for everything. And I think that one of the one part of the art of meditation is tuning into the silence, or tuning into the absence of something, you know, the non-occurrence of something. And in our daily lives, we usually pay attention to what's happening, you know, what's occurring. And that is very useful. You know, someone says, "Hey, Max," you know, what? You know. And in the meditation as well, we're paying attention to what's happening, the breath, the body, the sounds. But there's also something else that's there. So, you know, when there's the absence of reactivity, when there's the absence of kind of reacting mind, another kind of silence can bloom. And so anyway, I was appreciating that and appreciating all of you, you know, for coming here. It's been a long time since I've been here on a Monday night. And I remember when I was starting my practice, it was so supportive and so helpful to come and sit with other people. You know, of course, you can just sit in your living room. Hopefully you come here and you get some benefit and you get that support. And then by the fact of your being here, you're supporting everybody else, you know. So just appreciating that and how beautiful it is. Been told to turn this off when I drink water. So. Listening. So, and also appreciating the many different reasons why we come here. why we come to this practice. I think the specifics of what draws us to meditation, to mindfulness, are unique for each of us. There's usually some theme, you know, some thread that runs through. And just that you've come here, that you've walked through the door, you know, is very significant when you think of how rare that is, how rare it is to encounter this practice. You know, so I just feel very happy for all of you. And when I think about why we do this practice, there seems to be this theme that often is something like, you know, if I slow down, if I learn to be more attentive to myself and to the people in my life will work better. You know, I'll be more available, I'll be happier, something like that. And along these lines, I think many of us come to practice with this sense of, you know, there's me, you know, I'm in here. The world is out there. And there's some kind of, combination of rearranging the things in my life, the things in the world, and I just get them right. Then, you know, it's like, then I can, you know, X, whatever it is, be happy or be really practice, or then I can really, just fill in the blank. But it's like often this sense of rearranging things in the world. And usually the problem's out there, right? You know, it's like, if only everybody else would just get out of the way, just get there on time. And then, you know, so one of the insights, you know, at least I experienced this in my practice, one of the beginning insights that dawned on me was that, let me say, it's like, you know, maybe the source of my problems or of this feeling of discontent or, you know, or whatever it is not entirely out there, you know, and maybe it has something to do with me, you know, something to do with how I am, how I'm relating. I remember the first long meditation retreat I did, which was about 3 months, and at some point there was, I hadn't planned to do this, but there was this kind of like almost spontaneous reviewing of my life, you know, reviewing of different things bubbled up, memories, conversations. And I had this sense of almost for the first time seeing myself in a more objective way. You know, I wouldn't say it was totally objective, but and that was very difficult. You know, it was very painful. It was like kind of a cringeworthy moment. It's like, I can't believe I said that. You know, I can't believe I did that. So I see that as part of this insight process. You know, it's different for everybody, but this, you know, so we tend to see according to this fundamental duality of myself and the world, you know, self and other. And, so either we're rearranging the world, trying to rearrange the world, which is usually not very successful, or we're trying to rearrange ourselves in some way, you know, and which is okay. But the danger of that is that our practice becomes this kind of self-improvement project. And I've gone through that as well. And when we come to practice, we tend to perceive things as I want to say permanent, you know, solid. You know, the world is made up of you know, these kind of solid things. You know, it's how things are. You know, we know logically that things change, but it's just somehow in our nature this irresistible pattern of assuming things will continue on the way they've been going. You know, it's like the way our minds work. You know, so we come to practice with these assumptions about ourselves, about the world and its solidity, about what it will take to make us happy. And so all of this is to say that the unfolding of this practice, of insight practice, is a process of gradually, and sometimes not so gradually, sometimes suddenly, overturning all of these assumptions that we have about ourselves, about life, about the world. And that process of overturning, that process of seeing, is called insight. You know, that's the insight in insight meditation. So it's said that the purpose of this practice is to cultivate insight into the way things are, into the nature of things. And in this tradition, insight refers to three specific perceptions, which you've probably come across before, which are impermanence, unreliability, or unsatisfactoriness, and not self. So it's said that all conditioned existence, which simply means anything that we can experience through the five senses and through the mind, has the quality, has the characteristic of being impermanent, unreliable, and not self. This may sound like a little bit of a downer, but it's good news, and we'll get there. But and just to say a few things about this before going on, it's like I think for myself there were a number of years in my practice where I had heard these teachings a lot, and I heard about these three insights a lot, but I didn't really connect with them, and they didn't have much personal significance for me. Of course, I knew them intellectually. And I was much more involved with my own process of just, you know, being with the breath, being with the body, and I didn't want these conceptual overlays. So all that's to say that don't feel like, you know, there's any particular need to remember these or know them, because these insights in this practice, these insights are not beliefs. You know, they're not something to believe, like all good Buddhists believe in impermanence. You know, they're meant to be something that we discover, you know, in ourselves, you know, something we discover in our lives through our practice. So, you know, they function as insights that arise through moment-to-moment mindfulness. So there's no need, so I guess what I'm saying is the most important thing to remember about them is you don't need to remember them. And in fact, most of the time, we don't talk about insight We talk about the way to, the way insight arises, the way to make insight your own, which is through the practice of mindfulness. You know, so it's often much more helpful to talk about the practice than to talk about, you know, the fruits of the practice. All that said, maybe just to take these in and let them percolate, you know, to kind of treat them as seeds. So we often call these three insights characteristics because they characterize our life, our world. They're also called the three perceptions. And the reason is that these are ways of seeing, ways of meeting our experience and seeing our experience that lead to letting go, that lead to freedom. So the first of these is impermanence. The Pali word is anicca. And it means change. It simply means change. In a way, it's so obvious, you know, how could we miss it? But it's also can be so difficult to fully accept. We live in the world of change. We live in the realm of change. Moment by moment by moment, everything is changing. Simply constant change, constant transformation. Our bodies, our feelings, our thoughts, our moods, even the mountains and the stars and the planets, you know, everything is changing. This is so fundamental to the practice that I think this is the story. One time, Suzuki Roshi, who is a teacher at the San Francisco Zen Center, founding teacher in the Zen Center, was asked by a student, please, you know, all of these teachings get so complicated. Please sum up Buddhism in one word. And he said, everything changes. Everything changes. Everything changes. So sometimes this change is compared to flowing water, you know, that never comes back. Flowing water never comes back. It just keeps going. And it reveals its nature in this eternal movement. One of the ways this realization can manifest in our practice is truly realizing the preciousness of each moment. You know, when we really, really in our bones sense impermanence, you know, we know things only happen once, and we want to be here. We want to. Savor, cherish the preciousness of this moment. My wife is from Japan, and I'm always struck by how, this is a little bit of a stereotype, but I'm always struck by how whenever Japanese people see cherry blossoms, even a painting of cherry blossoms, the tears start, you know, it's really meaningful. It's really, cherry blossoms are, in Japan, this expression of how life is fleeting, you know, they bloom, they blossom just for a few days, and then they fall, you know, until the next year. And when I see a group of Japanese people in a museum standing around the cherry blossoms, I say, I understand. As you heard, I have a daughter who's 18 months, almost 18 months old. And I think about this when I look at her, you know, it's like this moment will never come again. You know, those baby teeth, once they fall out, you know, will never come again. So we tend to highlight the big changes that happen in life, you know, when a loved one dies, you know, all these milestones of life. You know, but change is something that's happening constantly. And one of the ways that meditation works is by, we train ourselves to observe more and more carefully, more and more closely, observing our experience. And we begin to refine our perception of change. You know, sensations changing, sounds changing. I don't know if you remember the first time you found out the way a cartoon works, you know, a television cartoon. And I think I was in school or something, and we got those books, and you kind of flip through them. And it was like, oh, it's not really moving. It's this kind of illusion of consciousness that actually, frame by frame, things are happening. And, you know, and through meditation, it's like if you think about it, usually our mindfulness is like going at this speed and change is happening like this. You know, so it seems like change is happening really fast. And then as our mindfulness becomes sharper, the mindfulness is keeping up with what's happening. And then it seems like everything slows down. I don't know if you've ever been, you know, hopefully you never will, a kind of car accident or something, where it seems like time just slowed down. And it's like, you know, actually the mind sped up, awareness sped up, mindfulness sped up. You know, and it can be very powerful to be with someone who's so in tune with impermanence, you know. Maybe someone who's coming to the end of their life, and is so present, so in tune. The mindfulness is so sharp. You know, so change is change is what makes life possible. There can be no life. There can be no growth without change. You know, in this way, it's considered the easiest of these insights to see. And we can know it intellectually, yet to really accept it, to really integrate it into our heart is, I think, the work of a lifetime. And one of the things I would like to say with each of these insights is just suggest a way of practicing with it. And with impermanence, it can be very helpful to notice when we misperceive impermanence, and when we see things as being permanent. I had this experience very strongly somewhat recently when a close friend passed away. And, you know, intellectually, I knew, you know, he had been sick for a while, and I knew, you know, what was going to happen. But there was part of me that just wouldn't accept it, you know, that had just was just holding on and was just resisting. And then it was like the news of his death was a shock, you know, and I was like, why is this a shock, you know? Because it was like, you know, there was this misperception, you know, this, you know, some part of me so didn't want that to be true that it was just like a shock. And so, you know, maybe you can relate to this with, you know, something like this. You know, we have this sense of things are always going to be this way. And just noticing that, you know, it's just enough to notice that. And so precisely because we don't fully accept impermanence, the second characteristic arises, which is the Pali word is dukkha, which is sometimes translated as suffering or stress. You know, we want something to be lasting, we want something to be safe, to be secure, to be permanent. And when we realize it isn't, we suffer. Dukkha as an insight, dukkha as one of these three insights, is often better translated as unreliability. So the unreliability, unsatisfactoriness, you know, whatever is impermanent is inherently unreliable, you know, for the purpose of clinging, for the purpose of holding on. It's like if everything is flowing water, if you try to grab the water in your hand, it doesn't really work, you know. It's not the nature of water. We can't pick it up. So this is dukkha. This is unreliability. And so according to this view, when we look to rely on something that's unreliable, we create many problems for ourselves. We tend to look for satisfaction, for reliability, you know, in our bodies, our thinking, our memories, relationships, finances, career, whatever, you know, whatever we can. And from this way of understanding, this sets us up to suffer. And when we see what's unreliable as being unreliable, that's insight. You know, when we see dukkha as dukkha, that's insight. You know, and often this is an insight that comes when something happens in our life that somehow disturbs or shakes up this picture of who we think we are, of what we think life is about. It could be a relationship that we've depended on, it isn't working anymore. It could be a challenge to our health or a challenge to a loved one's health. It's like, you know, we start to see the unreliability of the body. You know, to see this deeply is what allows the mind to let go, to open up and let go. And what I would say is we know how to do this because we do this so many times in the course of a day. It's like, you know, having, you know, as a parent of a small child, it's like, we want things to be one way, and then somehow, you know, it turns out another way, and we have to let go of that, you know, of holding on to that idea. So what follows this is the teaching of not-self. The Pali word is anatta, which simply says, you know, in our human experience, body and mind, there isn't anything, any aspect of our experience that can be called a separate self. And if you think about it, if everything is changing, and everything is, because it's changing, it's unreliable for the purpose of holding on. Nothing there can be a permanent self, can be a separate self. Not any aspect of this world of change, of this world of unreliability, is worth calling a self. That's another way of saying it. You know, of course we have some agency, we have some control over how we are, how we act in the world. And there is an important role for having what I could, maybe we can call psychologically this healthy sense of self. You know, sense of integrity, of confidence, of coherence, all good things, responsibility. But there's also a lot about our body and our mind that we can't control. You know, we can't stop our body from aging. We can't stop our body from eventually getting sick, from eventually dying. We can't even stop our minds from wandering. You know, it's like, how much control do we really have? And so I think this idea of not-self is often very challenging because we tend to experience our life through the prism of self, through the prism of a sense of self. And so the way I think about it, the way I understand it, is the fundamental logic is this. If the Buddha is saying that all things, all phenomena that we can experience are impermanent and are not self, when we call something, one of those things, the self, we suffer. In this way, the sense of self is inextricably tied up with suffering. The sense of self gets built through clinging. When there is grasping and clinging in the mind, the sense of self arises. When things are clearly seen as impermanent, as unreliable, the mind can let go. How I summarize these three insights for myself is much more simple than all this stuff. Things change, we change, and usually this causes suffering. When we see, when we deeply see that things change, when we deeply see that we change, we're not this separate entity that's apart from nature, but we're a process, you know. When we deeply see this, freedom is possible. And so the suggestion here is the self is not this separate entity, but rather this activity. You know, the self is something that we actually do. When we identify with something as me, mine, myself, I told the story at the retreat last weekend, but when my daughter was 6 months old, she was playing with her cousin, who's about 3 months older. And they were in the living room, and she had this toy. I think it was like this little kind of bouncing ball. And she had it in her hand. And her cousin, who's a boy and who's older, you know, and he just came over, he just took it. And my daughter's reaction was this like, oh, you know, it's not there anymore. Huh. But there was this total, there was no agitation, no holding on, no possessiveness. It was just like, oh, another, it was like anicca, change. And it was like, and then she was like, I looked around, and then she saw, oh, you have it. You know, her cousin who just took it. She kind of crawled over to him, and she took it. No. And he was like, oh, it's not there anymore. There it is. And he took it. And then she saw it, and then she took it. And I thought, you know, this is like these two old Zen masters, you know, passing the ball back and forth, you know. And the reason I remember this story is that a couple weeks ago, we were looking at nursery schools with my daughter and with a cousin. And we went into the school, and they kind of, you know, and all the kids are quietly having their snack, and they had these little foam blocks to play with for my daughter and cousin. They were playing with them. And then at some point, we had finished talking, it was time to go. And the cousin was putting, you know, putting all the stuff, toys back in the bin. And he saw that Sasha, my daughter, had this one block that she was holding onto. And he was like, right, that needs to go back in the bin. And so they both walk now, so he walked over to her. And he tried to take it, just like he used to. She was not having any of that. And she's stronger now as well, and she was holding on to it. So he pulled harder. So then she pulled harder. Finally, she let out this, he says, blood-curdling shriek. And he let go. I thought, you know, this is the birth of the self. You know, this is, you know, the sense of mind, the sense of me. And how as adults, you know, we've kind of learned not to, you know, we just shriek on the inside. You know, So the way of practicing with not self is more like this invitation to investigate when the sense of self arises. You know, when the sense of me, when the sense of mine arises, and what does it feel like? You know, what are the consequences of that? You know, how we take birth as the one who, whatever, is the one who needs to do it right, the one who is anxious about not getting it right, the one who, you know, who, you know, how do you take birth? You know, how does the self, how does the self arise in the moment? And it's this investigation, is the self something that's ever present? Or, you know, is it a condition? You know, a condition that arises and passes moment to moment. You know, so these are the three insights, the impermanence, unreliability, and not self. And what I think is the really interesting thing about these is they're not something we can do. You know, it's like you can't do insight. You can't think it your way to insight, and it's not something that we figure out. You know, it took me a long time in practice, really trying to figure it out. And so it's like, now my understanding is more of like, insight is just something that happens to us. And there's that old saying, insight is an accident, but you can make yourself accident prone. You know. And so what does it mean to make ourselves accident prone? Well, the time-tested way is through very simple, steady, moment-to-moment mindfulness, moment-to-moment, being here, being present, accompanying ourselves. When we slow down and pay attention, we can see more. You know, we see more details. And I would suggest one other pointer or one other close cousin to insight is silence. Insight is closely related to silence in my understanding. You know, and again, this is not the kind of silence that requires no noise. It's not the kind of silence that, you know, we need those great noise-canceling headphones that that are great for the airplane. But it's like this quieting from the inside. When the chatter begins to quiet, begins to calm, insight has a chance to blossom. A mind that moves a lot tends to see solidity. You know, a mind that moves a lot tends to see self. A mind that's still, a mind that's silent, sees impermanence. A mind that's still, a mind that's silent, sees not self. A silent mind is the ground for seeing change and seeing how letting go can be possible. I'd like to end with a poem, if that's okay. Slightly over, but we'll... This is May Sarton. Can I weave a nest of silence? The Phoebe sits on her nest, hour after hour, day after day, waiting for life to burst out from under her warmth. Can I weave a nest of silence? Weave it of listening, listening, layer upon layer. But one first must become small, nothing but a presence, attentive as a nesting bird, proffering no slightest wish toward anything that might happen or be given. Only the warm, faithful waiting contained in one's smallness. Beyond the question, the silence, before the answer, the silence. One of the most famous teachings of the Buddha says, all mental conditions are impermanent. Quieting them is happiness. Calming them is happiness. Bringing them to peace is happiness. So may you know the peacefulness of a silent mind, and may the peace and the happiness of the Buddha be yours again and again. Thank you.